is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, six after here on the Steve Gruber Show. Glad to have you with us. Here's a story sure to get lots of traction today. White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, after meeting with Steve Bannon at the CPAC get-together, it was revealed late yesterday that he apparently asked a top FBI official to dispute media reports that President Trump's campaign advisors were in frequent touch with the Russian intelligence community during the election. That, according to a White House official and the Associated Press late Thursday, the White House confirmed Thursday night that the conversation between Priebus and FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe did occur on February the 15th, but said it was McCabe who initiated the contact to inform Priebus that a New York Times report was overstating the nature of their investigation, according to Politico. To be clear, it was the FBI that contacted the White House to rebut the New York Times story, said White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer late last night. We merely asked them to inform journalists of the same point that they were making to us. Priebus's discussion with McCabe sparked outrage among Democrats who said he was violating policies intended to limit communications between the law enforcement agency and the White House pending investigations. So there you go. That's going to get a lot of traction. No question about that. Let's go to Matt in Okemos. Matt, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I want to say about the transgendered bathrooms, it should be don't ask, don't tell instead of show and tell, because they want to go in there and show that they have proof. We're not blocking them from going to the bathroom. Just go use the bathroom.
I agree with that. Show and tell we don't need.
Yeah, we don't need show and tell. The other thing is stop and frisk. Have the community vote on it, not the mayor mandate it. The community will vote on it. 80% of the people are usually good people. They'll say, yeah, I want stop and frisk. We got thugs here.
Yeah, we've got people who need to clean up the problem. I appreciate it, Matt. Thanks for calling. It is Free for All Friday, 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966, the number if you want to drop in and share some comments or some conversation. I was with Sean Spicer yesterday on the Skype deal, and my conversation was about taxes because I am concerned about this. This border adjustability tax, because I think it has the potential to hurt manufacturing businesses here in Michigan and therefore hurt the economy potentially. This border adjustability tax is not something supported by the president, my understanding, but let me share my conversation during the press briefing yesterday. It came in by Skype. Most people probably were at work when that happened, so I thought I would share. It's Cut 12. It's me and Sean Spicer.
Thank you, Sean. I greatly appreciate it. I'd like to talk to you more about tax policy, if I may. President Trump, of course, on the campaign trail talked a lot about tax policy and tax reform. That hasn't happened yet, as we know, but I want to talk about something different. That's the border adjustability tax. And with the manufacturers that were at the White House again today, states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, others have a great concern about this tax. And there seems to be a disconnect between some of the CEOs, some of the Republicans on Capitol Hill, and the president as to whether or not this is appropriate. And I guess the question is, could this tax have a chilling effect on manufacturing at a time when places like Ohio and Michigan in the upper Midwest are trying to jumpstart the economy with manufacturing jobs? I wish for you to clarify, if you could, the president's position.
Yeah, Steve, thank you. I think the president has been very clear from the beginning that there is no tax if companies manufacture in the United States. We are one of only a handful of countries that doesn't tax the imports that come into our country. Almost every other country operates their tax code under that system. And so what happens is we have a system by which companies abroad can send their products tax our products going into their country, institute an import tax, and then their products come into the United States with no import tax, which frankly gives a disincentive to companies to stay in the United States, to manufacture in the United States, to hire in the United States, and it tilts the field against the American worker. And so the president is looking at tax policy that encourages manufacturing and job creation in the United States. And if you think about it,
border adjustability tax. Hold on. Where is he on this tax specifically?
I understand that, and I think that what he is doing is he met yesterday with his team on the budget. He's talked to Secretary Mnuchin and others who are working on a comprehensive tax reform plan. And remember, Steve, this isn't something that's been done since 1986. And so, as we look at it, part of that is to make sure that we lower our corporate tax rate, that we make it more attractive to manufacture and grow jobs in the United States, to make our companies more competitive with companies overseas that frankly have better tax treatment than our own companies who stay in the United States. So creating more of a playing field that encourages manufacturing and growing and creating in the United States. But make no mistake, if a company's in the United States already and expanding in the United States, it will be only to their benefit. If you think about it right now, the way the current tax code works, it almost incentivizes companies from leaving the United States, manufacturing and expanding overseas, and then sending their goods and services back to the United States, which undermines our own economy. It undermines our workers.
The question is about components coming back into the United States,
Steve,
and being manufactured.
Okay. I know that you're on the Skype, but we only do like one or two follow-ups. But the answer is that he's working toward comprehensive tax reform, and we'll have a plan out within the next few weeks that will address that.
I guess he didn't like being pressed on the question. But I thought that he kind of alluded me a little bit. Anyway, it won't be a problem, I'm assured, because it was just a conversation about taxes. No big deal. Let's go to the hotline. Dana checking in from Grand Rapids. Dana, welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve. Good morning to you. I have a comment on the transgender. This is my thought on it. In private schools, that nonsense isn't allowed. It neither is blue hair or pink hair or piercings all over your face or up your ears. That's what they need to do with public schools. This is ridiculous. Those are my tax dollars. And by the way, my parents, they double-dipped on my parents because I had 12 years of private education. We were in uniforms. Our hair was clean. In grade school, we had to wear matching socks with our uniforms. So we were very restricted on what we could do.
Right, because if it was a distraction.
That is not their job. I am paying taxes so you can get an education, not so you can express your individuality. When you're paying for your school, it's called college, you can do what you want to do. But as far as the transgender part of it, even in college, I don't agree with it. But this is a fact. There is less than 0.1%. They used to call them cross-dressers, and most of these transgenders aren't true transgenders. They're pre-operative. And a lot of them, the majority, don't even go through the full operation.
Well, you seem a little, it's fine, Dan. I greatly appreciate the conversation. And that's why we have this disconnect right now. People have very strong feelings either way, but about the distractions in schools, I get it. It's free-for-all Friday. Dana having a free-for-all. So was I with Sean Spicer. We'll be right back.
Keeping you in touch with Michigan and the world.
All right, Free for All Friday, 18 past the hour. Real quickly to Mike checking in from Ann Arbor. Mike, welcome to it.
Hi, Steve. Very quickly, to the Republicans in Congress, stop whining, stop wringing your hands, get to work like the president, do your job. If you don't want to do your job, quit and come back and really do go back to work and earn your living, period.
Agreed, Mike. Well done. Well stated. The professor is here, Steve Doolin, because we have to sort out this Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals basically saying that any weapon that could be, you know, beneficial to the military is not protected by the Second Amendment. Completely opposite of what the Supreme Court has ruled time and again, because what's common and normal is protected, completely ignores the Heller case. This is, well, I don't know what it means exactly. That's why the professor is here. member of the board of directors of the Michigan Coalition of Responsible Gun Owners, Professor Steve Doolin, everybody. What's up?
I've been reading this opinion, and all I can say is that, read Traxler's dissent if you're going to start reading the actual opinion. Read Traxler's dissent first so that you can... He makes more sense of the majority opinion than most people could at all. It makes no sense. It flies in the face of previous U.S. Supreme Court cases, including Heller, including even, really, the Miller case from the 1930s, which has been widely accepted as being wrongly decided for a number of reasons.
Let me read part of that. Let me jump in and read part of that dissent. Today, the majority holds that the government can take semi-automatic rifles away from law-abiding American citizens in South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, and Maryland. The government can now tell you that you cannot hunt with these rifles. The government can tell you that you cannot shoot at targets with them. And most importantly, the government can tell you that you cannot use them to defend yourself and your family in your home. In concluding that the Second Amendment does not even apply, the majority has gone to greater lengths than any other court to eviscerate the constitutionally guaranteed right to keep and bear arms, says part of the dissent.
And it goes on from there. Arguably, this decision, you know, and thankfully, you know, for those who don't know, this only covers those states that you just read off.
Let me ask you something. If I'm a resident of the state of South Carolina today, can I walk into a gun store and buy an AR-15, yes or no?
Yes, because that state hasn't passed a local statute, a state statute like Maryland.
But if I walk into Maryland,
the door's open.
If I walk into Maryland and want to buy an AR-15 today, I can or cannot?
You cannot, probably. They're going to start making Maryland compliant ARs like they have for New York and California.
Whatever that means. So they'll have different handles. But it says, but this thing says anything that can be used in the course of military. I'm trying to, you know, read through it quickly as well. They're saying any semi-automatic rifle, any semi-automatic handgun would fall under what these guys have just said is not legal.
Well, no. Okay. They didn't say it wasn't legal for the entire circuit. What they said is, the Maryland law.
I understand
is okay
that, and I'm focusing on Maryland.
So the states still have to pass statutes, and the other states haven't yet.
But if the state of Maryland today, being a very liberal state, said we don't want semi-automatic handguns today, and it got signed today, semi-automatic handguns would be illegal in Maryland. If Maryland passed a statute today that said semi-automatic hunting rifles were illegal, it would stand under this ruling.
Agreed. Yes.
That's outrageous.
It is. Especially when you consider that the semi-automatic technology goes back to the late 1800s. This isn't new, semi-automatic.
And so what if it was?
Well, at least there'd be a little more logic to it, right? But what we're talking about is hundreds of millions, you know, so let's suppose the U.S. Supreme Court adopted this insane, I'll go so far as to say it is insane, the majority opinion in this 10-4 decision. If the U.S. Supreme Court adopted it, it would remove the protections of the Second Amendment and push it down and make it a local issue is what it would do.
This is unbelievable. This is what happens when you stack the courts with activist judges. The ruling, by the way, I believe was 10-4 in a split decision.
Right.
10 justices voted to say that the Second Amendment basically doesn't exist. I mean, that's in effect, that's what it's done here. The Second Amendment doesn't exist because any state, any local jurisdiction can vote out any gun they want. And if it can be used in war, hell, a single shot revolver can be used in war, a single action revolver. You know that.
Well, as General Patton said, the only tactical principle which is not subject to change is to do the maximum amount of damage to the enemy in the minimum amount of time with whatever means are at hand. So everything's useful in war.
That's right. And
everything,
as Ted Cruz said, a feather duster when he was at CPAC yesterday, you know, maybe that could be used and that could be outlawed by this. So where do you go from here? Clearly, you would hope, I think you would hope that this would go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But, you know, you've got four activist judges on the U.S. Supreme Court that have no use for the Second Amendment, have no use for actually upholding their oath to defend the Constitution. So then what?
I hope Senator Cruz is correct that there's going to be another vacancy fairly soon on the Supreme Court. Though I just read yesterday that Justice Ginsburg has vowed to hang on as long as she can. So, if you're a praying person, you know what to pray for there. Because we need a shift. Replacing Scalia with another pro-gun vote is going to maintain the 5-4 balance that held for Heller and McDonald as far as gun cases go. And Justice Thomas actually wrote a blistering dissent not that long ago to a U.S. Supreme Court decision not to hear an assault weapons ban case. So, Justice Thomas has sort of stepped up to the plate to some extent to fill the gap left by Scalia's passing. But we hope for, frankly, another vacancy and another chance for President Trump to appoint that sixth justice.
Well, we'll see what happens. And meanwhile, in the city of Chicago, the murder rate by guns because of violence at a pace higher than it was in 2016, a year that it was an all-time record-setting bloodbath. So the city with the most gun laws has the most violence. You do the math. Professor Steve Doolin, thank you as always.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, we'll be back in a moment with Pete Hoekstra here on the program. Sit tight.
Michigan, born and raised with Midwestern values and Michigan common sense.
All right, it's 33 after the hour. Now, here's a story you probably have not heard yet. I'm going to guess you haven't heard this story. And it's an important story because it places into context the concerns you may have as an American citizen for those out there doing the work for us and the hangover, if you will, from the Obama administration. There's a woman and a CIA agent, Sabrina D'Souza, sitting in a Portuguese jail waiting extradition to Italy, where she's likely going to sit for the next 4 years in prison because she was doing her job. Pete Hoekstra here, former chair of the House Intel Committee, to explain. Pete, this is a confusing story to me. Can you bring it into focus for us?
I sure will, Steve. But first off, congratulations for joining the White House press pool.
Well, I appreciate that.
And it's an honor to be on the radio with somebody who's part of the press pool. That's awesome. I love what they're doing, and I'm glad they picked Steve Gruber to be one of the people that will be on with them on a regular basis.
Well, we were also told, and I mentioned this earlier, but now that you bring that up, we were told, given every indication that the president will join us here on the program, they said it's going to be soon. We can't give you a date yet because he's quite busy, but he intends him and Mike Pence both to come back through places like Michigan that they won by narrow margins and know are important to their agenda going forward. So looks like pretty good days ahead.
Yeah, and if you need to, you can give him one of my slots sometime in the future.
Well, there you go. I appreciate that.
All right. Hey, the case with Sabrina D'Souza is a very important case because it's about one of our former CIA case officers. 2003, shortly after 9/11, we're doing a number of things to try to keep America safe, and they were very controversial. One of these was rendition. We would take people and we would move them to other countries. And in 2003, the CIA, with some cooperation, I believe, with the Italian government, decided that there was a potential terrorist in Italy with Egyptian ties, and that this person should be snatched in Italy and then rendered to Egypt. And that's exactly what happened. The CIA captured this person on the streets of Milan, rendered them back to Egypt.
So they're doing what they normally do. They're finding a dangerous individual, they're taking him off the streets, and they're going to go figure out what they know.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So these types of programs on an individual basis are approved by the National Security Council back then. So this is not a group of CIA people and Italian intelligence folks in Italy deciding, hey, we think this is a bad person, let's grab them and let's send them to Egypt. This goes all the way up the food chain through the CIA, goes up to the National Security Council. It may have actually even been reviewed by President Bush at the time. And they give the go-ahead. Grab this person, take him, and take him to Egypt. There's lots of other peripheral information around this whole event and these types of things. The bottom line is the Italian justice system, 2007, 2008, they decide that they are going to identify, they finally identify who was involved in this, and they prosecute these Americans in absentia. Six, seven of these people, Americans, are convicted in absentia.
Right.
Two of them eventually are pardoned. One has their sentence reduced, so they don't have to worry about extradition. Sabrina has dual citizenship. She's an American and she is a Portuguese person. All of her family lives in Portugal. So she leaves the CIA. She goes back to visit her mother, who's very, very still, who's very, very sick. About a year and a half, 2 years ago. She is then detained by the Portuguese and said, you cannot leave the country. There is an Interpol arrest warrant out for you. You need to stay in the country. So she has been in this state of uncertainty now for over 2 years.
Limbo, really. She's just kind of been in limbo, legal limbo, but no longer. In fact, things got much worse for her.
That's right. 4 days ago, she was picked up by the Portuguese police. She was put into, she's now been in prison for 4 days. Pending her extradition to Italy, where she will begin serving her four-year term. Now, I disagree with you. I do not believe that ultimately she will serve 4 years. The American people will not tolerate, a CIA case officer sitting in an Italian jail for 4 years for doing what the White House asked her to do.
Well, I would normally agree with you under normal circumstances, but I see these people in the streets bad-mouthing the United States of America every day, and it makes me wonder, Pete, if some of these people wouldn't say, see, that's what you deserve, that's what should happen, just because I'm like, some days I wonder who these people are, you know what I mean? But go on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there will be some Americans who say that, but Donald Trump will not let her be in this position. For 7 years, Barack Obama had the option to, go to the Italians and say, hey, this is ridiculous. Throw out these convictions. Leave my people alone. The Italians were involved in this. Your judicial system is all screwed up. But an ally of ours, someone who wants to be an ally of ours, is not going to threaten American case officers. But for 7 years, Barack Obama did nothing. John Brennan, the former CIA director, was in Portugal twice last year, and with sources that we have going into the Portuguese intelligence community, the word is he never brought up the issue of Sabrina, so he left her out hanging. And, there are case officers, people who work for the CIA, people who work for the United States overseas, who are watching this very, very closely, because if we don't stand up for Sabrina and get her released,
then who do we stand up for? The concern that I have here, you told me this story a couple of days ago. We were visiting about this. It concerns me how many hundreds, thousands of agents out there will say, well, now, wait a second. If they don't have my back, what am I doing out here? I'm just out, in space with no protection. I mean, that has got to be horrible for morale.
It's a horrible position because, remember, what do spies do?
Spy.
They steal information. They break the laws of other countries each and every day, and they do that because we as a government believe that these things need to be done to keep America safe. So they put themselves at, legal risk each and every day, and as we frequently also know, they also put themselves at physical risk each and every day by doing some of the most dangerous things that a government will ask its own people to do. We need to stand up. We need to defend. We need to defend Sabrina and people like her. And I've got confidence that Donald Trump and his administration, that they will not let Sabrina or people like her sit in our allies' jail.
I certainly hope you're right about that. And,
yeah.
We're going to keep a close eye on this one because this one is very disconcerting to, well, like you said, we can't have an American agent doing their job at the request of the administration, any administration sitting in jail for that matter. Pete Hoekstra, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, there you have it, everybody. Former chair of the House Intel Committee, Pete Hoekstra from Michigan, here on the program. Good friend and a good friend of the program as well. It's the Steve Gruber Show on Free for All Friday, 41 after.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
Back to it. My next guest here, Tim Meyer, professor of law and enterprise at Vanderbilt's Law School. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, I understand you were a former clerk for a judge that has become, well, quite famous recently. His name is Neil Gorsuch.
That's right. Yeah, I clerked for Judge Gorsuch from 2007 to 2008, so about 10 years ago, just after he was confirmed at the Court of Appeals.
Have you stayed in touch since your time working with him?
I have, yeah. Yeah, I've stayed in regular contact with him. I've actually spoken to him since the nomination just to express my congratulations and best wishes.
So tell us about, we've seen what's on TV. We know what people say about him as far as his, you know, his rulings and his decisions and so forth. But let's go behind the curtain a little bit. Tell me a little bit more about Neil Gorsuch as a human being beyond just being a judge.
Well, you know, he is, I would say, one of the kindest and most decent guys that I have ever met and certainly ever had the pleasure of working with. He, law clerks do is they essentially advise a judge on cases and they help the judge with research. And so you're working actually in pretty close quarters with the judge. So it's a judge typically and four law clerks and an assistant. And so you get to know a judge pretty well, and a judge really has to take a chance on a young attorney when the judge hires the young attorney, typically right out of law school.
So so you're kind of in the trenches, if you will, for lack of a better term. You're right in there with him. You're working on decisions together. You're having discussions back and forth. It becomes an intimate relationship.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I would say, you know, he is one of the people that I have most enjoyed working with over the course of my career. He was a great mentor. He was a great teacher, and he was a great guy. He welcomes clerks. Most of his clerks are not from Colorado, and so he welcomes everybody into Colorado and into his extended family, and he loves the outdoors. He shows the clerks, you know, skiing, hiking, fly fishing.
Oh, that's important because, I remember from A River Runs Through It, you can't trust a man who doesn't fish, you see.
Yeah.
So we trust him because he's a fly fisherman. Now, if he's good at it, it concerns me because then he's just showing off. I'm kind of a hack, but I do love it. But okay, so he's a real guy, a family, a guy that you got to know, a guy that has, you know, that has a real, you know, a real human being. Because oftentimes what you get on TV is a caricature. I mean, you know that. You get some sort of a takeaway that the media turns into something, and sometimes it's not really close to the truth. So the reason I wanted to give this background to the listeners was then, okay, extend that now into who he is when it comes to jurisprudence, when it comes to sitting on the bench and becoming potentially the next justice of the Supreme Court. He brings all that with him. And to me, that sounds like it's a good package.
I think that's right. You know, one of the things you want in a judge, I think, is somebody who is just a fundamentally fair person. I mean, we sometimes forget this in talking about Supreme Court nominations, but ultimately the cases the justices hear are between two parties who typically have a complaint, and ultimately one of them is going to probably lose. And so you want to know that you have a judge there who is listening hard to the arguments that you're making, approaching them fairly, and is himself in his personal life and in his professional life somebody who gives everybody a fair shake. And I think in Judge Gorsuch, that's exactly what you're going to get.
So now, as being a professor who has served with him, and now you're at Vanderbilt, I mean, help me if I'm wrong here, Professor, but it seems to me that the political landscape is that there are a lot more justices that are left of center, activist judges, really, than there are those that are more constructionist in nature, like Antonin Scalia was and Neil Gorsuch appears to be. Does that make life more difficult for you as a professor and for Neil Gorsuch to get confirmed?
I don't think so. I mean, right now, you know, it depends a little bit on what you consider to be left of center. But right now, you know, the court is fairly evenly balanced at 4-4. And so if Judge Gorsuch were to be confirmed, he would replace Justice Scalia and would, I think a lot of people think, sort of restore a 5-4 balance. That'd be five Republican appointees, four Democratic appointees. And, you know, I think that that does play into the minds of how Democratic senators think about it. I think when Judge Garland was nominated, they expected that it would be the other way, that it would be five Democratic nominees, appointees, and four Republicans. And so I do think that that, just as a political matter, complicates the nomination. But I think that when the senators meet him, they're going to be so impressed with just how thoughtful he is. And again, just what a decent man he is, that it's going to be difficult for them to resist.
Well, when I look at, and when I say left of center, I'm looking at other decisions around the country that would end up on the desk of the Supreme Court. Most notably 2 days ago from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals that in effect upheld Maryland's ban on semi-automatic rifles, handguns, pretty much anything Maryland decides that they don't want is a gun in their state now, based on this Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling. They basically undermined the entire Second Amendment. So that's why I talk about justices that are left, justices are right. Donald Trump has a large amount of work to do in front of him. What do you think it's going to take, though, for your former boss to get confirmed? What's it going to take to get a few Democrats to cross the aisle? I think people like Joe Manchin might, and there's some others that might, Professor. But who do you think might be the ones that'll come across and make it so you don't have to go for the nuclear option?
So the last time I looked, there actually were, I think, already nine Democratic senators who had voted, who had indicated that they would support giving Judge Gorsuch an up or down vote. And so Senator Manchin was one. Senator Tester was another. I believe Senator Blumenthal had indicated that he was open to that. So I think that it's looking fairly positive. And I always hesitate, of course, in politics, anything can happen.
But, certainly.
I think it looks fairly hopeful that we will be able to avoid the nuclear option.
Well, and I hope so, too, because I think that changes the Republican, and not in a good way. I think what Harry Reid did was wrong and unfortunate. Tim Meyer, professor of law and enterprise, scholar at Vanderbilt Law School, greatly appreciate your putting a human face on Neil Gorsuch. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure.
There you go. Tim Meyer, everybody, the professor, and Neil Gorsuch's former law clerk. And if the guy likes to fly fish, come on, what's not to like? 52 after on the Steve Gruber Show.